You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When Hopi tribal member Lori Ann Piestawa became the first female soldier to die in Iraq, attention was focused on Native Americans in the U.S. military. Many people in this country and around the world were also reminded that the face of the American soldier is not limited to the stereotypical Caucasian male. Over the past few months, Piestawa's family has traveled across the country to return the support they received from people of all races since Lori's death. Last Saturday, they attended a powwow on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation to honor Piestawa and other Native soldiers still fighting in Iraq. Percy and Terry Piestawa explained to Peace Watch correspondent Jim Kent who Lori was and why she was fighting in Iraq.
The Vietnam War was viewed by many as a white man's war, where minority soldiers were sent to the front lines in disproportionate numbers to fight for a cause that would never benefit them directly. Controversy surrounding the reasons for the war in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction that have yet to be found, the economic benefits of Reconstruction, and the possible control of crude oil, place the current conflict in that same category for many opposed to the Bush administration's war against Saddam Hussein. But the family of Lori Ann Piestawa does not fall into that category.
I don't believe that it's a white man's war. I think freedom has a price. Whether it doesn't matter what color we are, we're all Americans. Whether we're Native Americans, whether we're Hispanics, whether we're Anglo, whatever we are, we're all Americans. I feel that when our children go to fight, they go to fight for freedom for everybody, not just for one ethnic group.
Percy Piestawa is a traditional Native American, but an American nonetheless. She sees her daughter's death as part of Lori's role in the world to make others aware of the Native American presence in the U.S. military.
Had it not been for what happened to Lori, we would never have known the numbers of the Native American people who are out there. Now, because of the situation with Lori, it's coming up to the top, to the front, where people now know, yes, there are many Native Americans, many Hispanics, many other ethnic groups, not just Anglos, but all, again, Americans.
With a history in the U.S. military that dates back to the American Revolution, Native Americans have consistently sent more men per capita into the armed forces than any other racial group. Over 12,000 were in the trenches in World War I, 6 years before being recognized as citizens of the country they'd fought and died for. 44,000 served during World War II, another 42,000 fought in the jungles of Vietnam. And in the Gulf War, one out of every three Marines was Native American. The question, of course, is why? Why do young men and women, whose people have suffered so much at the hands of the federal government, volunteer to fight for a flag that nearly annihilated their culture? For some, it's a means of carrying on the warrior tradition of their culture. But for many, it's first the key to a better future, a college education, and a ticket out of the poverty and high unemployment rates of the reservation.
What she did for her children, I'm sure.
According to her father, Terry, a Vietnam combat vet, everything Lori did was for her children, Brandon and Carla Lynn. But even if she was in the military for job security and a college degree, Lori's reasons for being in Iraq were a bit more complex and rooted deep in her personality. Percy Piestawa.
Very determined. Not a quitter. She would, if she went out for something, she stuck to it. She stuck to her guns. She was... I feel that my daughter was there. She made a commitment, and she was there to follow the commitment that she had made and had signed for when she joined the military.
Terry Piestawa adds that the day Lori died, she stopped belonging to the Piestawa family alone.
And we don't say our daughter anymore because it's all of our daughter now. Because what she's done for the country is that she belongs to everybody now. And so we believe that. So she's not just our immediate family anymore. She belongs to everybody.
The world.
Mm-hmm. Oglala Sioux tribal member Bernadine Tallman helped organize the powwow that honored Lori Ann and her family. With two sons in the military, she understands what the Piestawa family has endured.
With my second older son being right there in Baghdad and everything that's happening there, I think it really brings home the fact that anything can happen. It doesn't matter if you're red, black, or white. It's bound to happen. I think Lori's death really had a big impact on Native Americans. And to me, it's like her death brought a unity among Native Americans.
Unity for Native Americans, an increased awareness of minorities in the military for non-Natives, and a legacy for Native children who Percy Pius II sees enjoying freedoms Iraqi children have been denied. All these are what the world should remember when thinking of Lorianne Pius II. What will her family remember?
She was an awesome child. She was always smiling, happy, lively, vibrant. We've always been very proud of her.
She was real sweet, but never liked the crowds or recognition. Even with all her accomplishments, she never liked it. And we're very proud that she's gotten these people all together.
For Peace Watch, I'm Jim Kent at the Pine Ridge Reservation's powwow to honor Native Americans in the military.
In a 2-1 ruling on June 17th, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., upheld the Bush administration's right to keep secret the names of some 700 immigrants arrested by the Justice Department after the September 11th attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. The ruling, expected to be appealed, is yet another victory for the Bush administration, whose rewriting of judicial procedures has been challenged by civil liberties groups. Speaking for the White House, Attorney General John Ashcroft has cited the war against terrorism as the justification for a steady erosion of rights accorded to immigrants and citizens. Recent court decisions have affirmed the Bush administration's right to hold secret hearings, indefinitely detain and deny access to attorneys to U.S. citizens labeled enemy combatants, and declared that Afghan prisoners held at the U.S. Guantanamo naval base in Cuba are not subject to protections embodied in U.S. constitutional law. Last month, the Justice Department's own Inspector General released a report documenting many abuses committed against immigrants held in secret detention, confirming the fears many opponents of these measures had expressed about the dangers inherent in secret imprisonment. Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines spoke recently with Arthur Spitzer, legal director of the ACLU's National Capital Area Office, who examines the long-term impact these series of court decisions may have on America's judicial system and civil liberties guaranteed under the Bill of Rights.
We were certainly disappointed, although not surprised, because we knew from months ago that we had the two most conservative judges on this particular Court of Appeals on our panel, along with one liberal judge. So it was really not a shock to us that the 2-1 majority bought the administration's argument that it was somehow going to be a serious blow to the war against terrorism for the government to tell us who they had arrested and were holding in detention here. It almost surely won't be the end of the line. The lawyers working on the case haven't made any final decision, but I would say it's likely that we will seek to take the case to the next step. People we were trying to identify were hundreds of people who had been rounded up mostly in the fall of 2001, people from Middle Eastern countries and Muslims, all men as far as I know, who had been picked up at the same time as the FBI was trying to determine whether there were other Al-Qaeda cells in the United States. And in the course of that investigation, they got thousands and thousands of tips, including things that were just, you know, there are some Middle Eastern men who live in my apartment complex and they often come home late at night, or they talk to each other in Arabic and I'm suspicious about them. Or they picked up people who just happened to be caught for a traffic violation or for some other minor offense and were taken into custody because they were Middle Eastern men. And if they discovered that such a person had a technical violation of immigration status, like they had overstayed their visa or they were here on a student visa and they were no longer a registered student, then they were detained. And even as we now know from the Inspector General's report from the Justice Department, even if it were quickly determined that the person had no connection to terrorism, they were not released. They were held in many cases for months under very extreme conditions in solitary confinement with virtually no access to their family or to a lawyer, until the FBI got around to clearing them and deciding that it had no interest in them anymore. And the FBI, the Inspector General has told us, gave that a very low priority. They had better things to do as far as they were concerned than to check up on these people who the Attorney General was telling us were you know, being detained because they were part of the anti-terrorism investigation. You'd think that would be a high priority. So they wound up sitting in jail for a long time before most of them were finally deported. We had filed this lawsuit in December of 2001 when these people were mostly still in detention, and we said, we have reason to think that these people have no connection to terrorism. We have reason to believe that they really haven't had access to lawyers. We have reason to believe they're being held in very onerous conditions. Secret arrests have never been part of the American judicial system. They've been part of the judicial system of totalitarian countries. And we want the government to tell us who it's arrested and who it's holding so that we can help them get lawyers if they want lawyers, and so that we can help the American people know what the government is up to here. The government strongly resisted that request and tried to persuade the court that that any interference with its anti-terrorism investigation would be bad for national security. The trial judge agreed with us and ordered the government to release the names, but that decision was stayed, was put on hold pending the appeal, and now the Court of Appeals says, essentially, when the government claims national security, the courts should defer to that assertion. The courts really have no strong independent role to play in keeping the government, forcing the government to obey the law if the government says national security would be harmed. I think that's really the gist of their decision, and of course that's a very poor decision from our point of view because we think the courts do have a very important role to play in preventing the excesses of the executive branch, which finds it very easy to say national security, especially if it knows that all it has to do is say that to avoid any oversight of its activities.
Where do you think public opinion is at vis-a-vis these erosions of civil liberties for non-citizens and citizens alike, and what is the possibility of reversing this erosion?
My sense is that the pendulum is swinging back towards common sense. I'm certainly not a public opinion researcher, and you may know the facts about this better than I do, but I certainly have the sense that people around the country and editorial pages around the country are beginning to realize that a lot of innocent people are being harmed in this anti-terrorism crusade, and that important as the crusade is, it's equally important to conduct it in a way that's A, effective, and B, minimizes the collateral damage to people in the United States and people abroad. Nobody's perfect, and of course the ACLU doesn't expect perfection from any government, but what we see in this administration is very little effort to care about the civil liberties of Americans and almost an exclusive focus on fighting terrorism without a lot of attention. You know, it's sort of a shoot first and ask questions later attitude. I think the American people are beginning to get that idea. It's very disappointing to us that the courts have not been more willing to put the brakes on, because we think that's a very important part of their constitutional duty. But more and more communities around the country have begun to pass resolutions calling upon Congress to repeal the worst parts of the USA Patriot Act. And I think as that political message gets heard on Capitol Hill and heard in the newspapers, judges read the newspapers, too, and maybe that will give them a little more backbone.
Arthur Spitzer, legal director of the ACLU's National Capital Area Office. He was speaking with Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines. Since September 11th, the U.S. government has increased security against foreign nationals in its fight against terror. In 2003, men from 24 Arab countries and North Korea registered with the INS under a new program designed to track foreign visitors. One man shared his experience with the registration process with Peace Watch reporter Benta Berklin.
A 26-year-old Moroccan man living in Northern Virginia who wishes to remain anonymous got a call from a friend last January telling him to register with the INS as part of the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System. On the last day he could register, he woke up, got dressed, and decided he would do this for America.
We were all expecting, like, to do the right thing. Just register so they can know our names, take our fingerprints and stuff, pictures and stuff. We were handcuffed, feet and arms. So they drag us from Boston to another place, I don't know where it was. At midnight, it was, I remember it was midnight. They took off our jackets and everything, so we were like practically naked there, and it was freaking cold. Then they took us to another place, and then they took us to Alexandria jail. Yeah, they call it processing.
He slept on the floor until he paid $1,500 bail the next day and was released. The registration system was established by the Department of Justice after September 11th to improve protection for U.S. citizens from possible terrorist threats. Hussein Ibish is the communications director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He said the INS registration system tracks those with minor violations and does little to protect the U.S. from terrorists.
We're not really necessarily talking about people who are here illegally as such, or people who have offenses that would be deportable anyway under immigration law. In many cases, we're talking about people who have completely trivial offenses, like being one student credit hour shy one semester, of their minimum limit. And the government says that in the course of this registering of hundreds of thousands of people, they found seven persons with, quote, links to terrorism, close quote. I don't know what that means. I mean, it certainly doesn't say that they arrested seven people based on suspicions of terrorism. It doesn't say that they found seven people who were a threat. It doesn't say what those links were. Basically, if you look at this program, it's been, you know, exceptionally onerous and abusive. Without producing anything that looks like tangible national security results.
The National Security Entry-Exit Registration is scheduled to be phased out over the next 3 years in favor of a program in which citizens from all non-visa waiver countries will be required to register at their point of entry into the U.S. The INS did not return calls seeking comment. Although he is angry about how he was treated, the young Moroccan man intends to stay in the U.S.
We turned ourselves in, so why the humiliation? We all are immigrants. Everybody here. If you're not Native Americans, you're an immigrant. All right, you came like 300 or 400 years ago. All right, it's my turn now. I just came too. So I think we deserve the same chance.
This is Benta Berkland for Pacificus Peace Watch.
With the federal court's decision that the names of detainees held since the September 11th attacks could be kept secret, many civil liberties groups gathered at the University of Massachusetts in Boston recently for a conference entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Following is a speech by the provost of the University of Mass, Winston Langley, who comments on human rights abuses post 9/11.
It seems to me that when we think of secrecy and the government, we often think in terms of the right we have to privacy. We think in terms of the need to have information for purposes of sharing between and amongst ourselves and to play a role, have that information play a role in shaping the development and direction of society. I think when governments find themselves involved in secrecy and surveillance, they do more than tamper with what we generally understand to be privacy and somehow move around the edges of supposedly subverting the democratic process. To me, it's more than the democratic process. It is the heart of what we call democracy. If you can see information as the currency through which democracy functions. It also has something to do with what we have come to call human autonomy, that somehow the information that we seek to secure and use and share helps us in almost every phase of life in acting with some degree of independence. And independence not only in the sense of being self-directed, but also from the standpoint of what we have come to call moral integrity, namely that one is not acting on the basis of some fear that the government is securing information that may be used against one now, one's family, that may be used against one's friends, it may be used in the future. If we act from fear, all of that moral integrity is destroyed. something else is at stake. What I call the principle to receive and impart. That's the heart of the human rights agenda when it calls for the free flow of information across all frontiers, across human frontier, across government frontiers, across national frontiers, across gender frontiers, all of the cleavages we can think about. When governments engage in surveillance and secrecy, they prevent the movement of this information. They subvert the principle of receipt and impart. Finally, it tampers with the essence of what we have come to call human dignity. Because if we must act without moral freedom, if we must act on the basis of fear, if we must betray our friends and our parents, and even our enemies, there can be no worth for ourselves and those whom we have a special responsibility to protect, namely other human beings.
Winston Langley is the author of the Encyclopedia of Human Rights Issues since 1945 and provost of the University of Massachusetts at Boston. Special thanks to Mark Weaver from community radio station WMBR for production assistance. Many residents of the U.S. have found themselves the victims of racial profiling. The Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York offer this political satire in response to the detentions that have occurred since September 11th, 2001.
President Bush signed an executive order banning racial profiling. Racial profiling is defined as using ethnic or racial stereotypes to target people for law enforcement attention. Back on the train. That's right. If you have the same last name as an early American president or a prominent plantation slave owner, this message is for you. If your name sounds like Gonzalez, Martinez, or Jimenez, please stay tuned for this important message from the Bush administration. The Bush administration has just announced their new Rainbow Freeway policy. So get in your cars and drive. Sudden access to new oil companies have made it possible for everyone to get behind the wheel. That's right. No more special treatment. No more racial profiling. It's okay for everybody. So get behind that wheel and suck up some gas. Offer may not apply in Michigan and other places where prohibited by law to anyone wearing a veil, Middle Eastern in appearance, or anyone named Muhammad. Circumstance beyond our control. The phone, TV, and the news of the world. Got in the house like a pigeon from hell. Hey, it's okay for everybody to drive. And just in time, put us back on the train. But according to the Bill of Rights, racial profiling already is illegal. Is unconstitutional in many ways, including the First Amendment protects the freedom to associate with people of your choice, the freedom to worship as you choose, the freedom to speak your mind and read what you want to read. It should protect you from being suspected, detained, arrested, and imprisoned because of who your friends are, what religion you practice, where you go to church, and what you say about anything and what you read. The Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures. The right not to be detained unreasonably. The Fifth Amendment gives us due process of law, the right not to be arrested except upon probable cause. Your Honor, I was convinced the accused was probably black. Back on the chain probably. Again. Or Latino. The Sixth Amendment gives us the right to a fair trial with an all-white, an impartial jury, the right to confront our accusers, the right to have counsel represent us,
By the way, the part where a lawyer would be provided if you can't afford one was added in the late 50s, the 1950s. The 14th Amendment applies all of the first 10 amendments to the states, meaning, in this context, state law enforcement officers. And nowhere in these amendments will you see a national security exception. All of these guarantees have been violated repeatedly hundreds of times since 9/11. Inspector General Glenn Fine of the Justice Department just released a report detailing these constitutional violations conducted in the interest of national security.
The Christmas Coup comedy players of Pacifica Stations, KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
What kind of world is this we are living in, where we are loved or hated by the color of our skin? What kind of emptiness would make you so unkind? What vain and heartless arrows poisoned your mind? What kind of place is this?
No More Lies by Walela from the Cherokee for Hummingbird album. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineers tonight were Scott Gurian with assistance from R.H. Brown. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Keith Shaljian, Benta Berkland, Jabari Zakia, and Richard Wright. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.